I'm Margaret Robinson. I'm researcher on the Two-Spirited Roundtable Project. And today I'm here with J. Andrew Baker, who's an Aboriginal gay man, talking with me about Two-Spirited identity.
Hello.
Andrew, what can you tell me about the concept of multigenerational trauma?
Multigenerational trauma, or intergenerational trauma, is the concept that you pass down the history of trauma of something that happened to you or your ancestors, and that you pass down the maladaptive behaviors that form as a result of that.
So most of us have heard about it in relation to residential schools,
yes,
for example, where people not only didn't learn traditional Aboriginal parenting skills, for
they
example,
didn't learn parenting skills,
but they learned some very negative skills.
So then
so
they
to speak.
Did that towards their children, and such moves forward. Secondary to that is the addictions that go along with the mental health impacts of what was going on at the time within residential schools: removal from family, removal from community, elimination of first language, physical abuse, as now is known publicly, nutritional experimentations. Mm. Those are very high traumas, and people manage those in different ways in order to maintain their life force. Whether I'm saying maintain mental health or not, mm-hmm, isn't the status. To
so
self-medicate.
Survival,
yes,
skills, essentially.
And they get passed down. What I think is of value is that Two-Spirit people have experienced many of those traumas, but their trauma roots back further in history, because history speaks about how they were the first people attacked.
You mean during colonialism?
Yes, during colonialism. Not that multigenerational trauma doesn't root from 1492 for most Aboriginal people, but there's a wiping out of Two-Spirit or Aboriginal-identified LGBT people from that history,
mm-hmm,
an immediate shift in mindset within community about who they were. So that carries a trauma. But when I think about multigenerational trauma, we look at different communities. As an example, the Jewish community post-Holocaust discusses, mm-hmm, second-generation and multigenerational trauma and did some amazing strategies to move forward from that, to help support adaptive behavior, as an example, to help support healing, restoration, these types of things, of a very good value. Queer community, when you think of multigenerational trauma, most people will say, well, queer community can't have multigenerational trauma because they don't have multiple generations. You don't bear your own children. Well, that's homophobic or transphobic or as broadly phobic as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. But we can understand historically in the way that we as a society have viewed LGBT people, that we understand where mainstream gets that perspective, where even our own community gets that perspective.
Yeah, I know as a person coming into queer community when I first did, you pick up attitudes towards things that are rooted in experiences you haven't had yourself.
Yes.
Like I remember the attitude that people had toward police repression and this expectation of, like, don't trust the police are out to get us.
Yes.
And I had never had a negative experience with the police related to my sexuality, yet I absorbed this attitude from peers who had or who had picked it up from previous generations.
And that's what I'm discussing, because that's where a lot of the trauma is transitioning. And what's unique about queer community is that multi-generational trauma for them comes from multiple sources.
Mm-hmm.
It comes from their natural or their birth family. All the bad things that we're you can't grow up to be a queer, you can't grow up to be a lesbian, I'll kill you, you're going to die of AIDS, mm-hmm, one day. I'm just going through the list of trauma.
Yeah, all those negative predictors, people sometimes say.
They get reinforced into us. And as we come into self-awareness, or as we come into understanding who we are, those come out like a giant filter, like a floodgate opens. And immediately those phrases, when you're a child, become traumatizing.
Yeah, it's amazing how I noticed how easily I was remembering. It was like every homophobic thing my family had ever said suddenly came rushing into my memory when I started coming out.
Yes, so I think that there's value that we discuss that,
mm-hmm,
because people might not adapt to that in a healthy way. People might not be able to go beyond that. People might fall into addictions, and do.
Yeah.
People may fall into unhealthy sexual behaviors, and they do. People, a variety of things. What I think is unique, though, is that that's just the natural family,
mm-hmm,
which in most cases, multi-generational trauma is transmitted, mm-hmm, in that source primarily. What's unique about LGBT community is that we then have a heart-chosen family.
Right.
Many of us generationally are abandoned by our natural family historically, so we go out and we make our own. And as a result of that happening for so many years, even people who have an accepting natural family tend to go and make their own family somewhere.
Yeah, it's like a queer tradition.
Because it's what queer people do. That family comes with its trauma.
Yeah.
That family comes with its history. And that gets passed on. As an example of what you said, that those family members in the initial time who were supporting you gave you the perception to not trust police.
Yeah. What have been the intergenerational traumas that you've inherited from your queer family?
That's a unique discussion. When I think of my natural family, it's the fairly traditional ones. When I think of my queer family, I think of the aspect around, and I've changed this, or I've adapted in a healthier way, that at the time when you first come out, for myself as a gay man and the gay men who were in my community and who were supporting me, was that you could really only relate to other men in a sexual manner.
Oh, so there's no such thing as just friends if you're
yes.
all gay.
Yes. And not that that means that everybody was sleeping with everybody or otherwise, but there was assumption that you would be if you were spending time with somebody, or there was assumption that you were cheating on somebody, or that you were going to no matter what, or that they were.
And do you think that's a reaction against the suppression of male sexuality if it's directed between men?
Exactly. Well, and I think it comes down to the fact that men, in a traditional sense, aren't allowed to be emotional.
Mm.
Therefore, men have a history of not being emotional in
so
an effective way.
So it gets channeled into sexuality.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's one of the traumas that I think of, is that I had to come to understand other ways of how to have relationships with men. And I don't know whether you've had a similar experience along the way. I think also one of the strongest traumas was the concept that you're going to die of AIDS one day. And regardless of whether you're HIV positive or not in our community, that can be a fear.
Yeah.
And even once you're HIV positive, it almost becomes less of a fear because you're on treatment, you know the environment, you know the dynamics. That's
yeah, that
a trauma.
Element of the unknown is removed.
Yes. And that's a trauma that's passed on as a result of the epidemic that happened
mm-hmm.
in the 80s. And when I was coming out, it was those people who went through that epidemic who were mentoring or supporting young men my age
mm-hmm.
to come into themselves, to grow up, to mature. So,
so
that's one of the traumas.
That trauma from
I inherited that perspective mm-hmm. that, yes. So those are examples of traumas that can be passed on.
What can you do about intergenerational trauma? Like if you're a person who's inherited, say, intergenerational family trauma or from within your queer community, what do you do to walk safely with that?
I think one of the things that's important is that we need to revisit and know our histories. Oftentimes we don't know where trauma's coming from or why.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know the history.
So bring it into consciousness.
Yes. We have a thought. As an example, the police are always going to be terrible with queer people.
Mm-hmm.
So we get defensive or we get militant or we get standoffish and shy. One of the above
yeah.
options. What's important to note is the concept of the history of where that comes from. Why do I think that? Who told me that? When did it occur? Why did that person think that way? What was their experience knowing that history? When we look at Aboriginal community, one of the ways that you overcome or start to overcome, as an example, residential school trauma in your family is by talking about what happened.
Mm.
And for many generations, that generation is now lost.
Yeah.
So about talking about what happened in the subsequent generation about how they were raised and maybe why, and coming to understand that there's dynamics at play.
Because I know a lot of people often suggest that we should just forget that period of our history, and sometimes people react very negatively toward people who want to even research that period and find
yeah.
out what did happen.
Because it hurts.
Yeah.
Because it's traumatizing even to research it.
Mm.
It's traumatizing to acknowledge it, because when you're trying to heal multi-generational trauma, you're pouring salt in a wound. It's not going to feel nice. It's not going to be easy and light and fluffy and without tears or, you know, and you're not going to feel better perfectly right away. That's not the whole point. The whole point is about revisiting to come to understand. And the point isn't to forget. The point is to let go or to choose to move forward.
So do you find if you do bring it into your consciousness and you do understand fully what happened, does the pain change in any way? Does it become less raw and immediate?
That's a difficult thing to define, because I think that's for each individual's perspective. But what I think happens that can be empowering in that process is a concept of acknowledgement.
Mm-hmm.
That when you're acknowledging that that's where something's coming from, you're able to make changes instead of things just occurring as an automatic behavior. It becomes a conscious process of what am I going to do about this feeling that I have? Or what am I going to do about this thing that happened to me or that happened to somebody else? How am I going to move forward in my life with this? Am I going to leave it back there? Am I going to hold it as a trauma? Or am I going to hold it? And most importantly, this is one of the things that I think is important, is that am I going to use those points in my life that were traumas to become points of empowerment for me? Points where I gain strength. Points where,
I do, yeah.
And that there can be a transformation in viewing trauma as an empowerment point. It's not that it ceases to be a trauma or that it ceases to be something bad. It was. But it's a point where a part of you became, or you gained a skill, or you gained a strength. And looking at the parts of that can be an empowerment process that can allow you to heal. Because then you start viewing that in a different way. You start to remember the strength that you gained over the experience that occurred. And that experience never leaves you, but now you come to a place of being able to have value within it.
No, that's some great advice. I especially think of when I was doing my master's degree and I was researching all of the sort of history of homophobia, both within the church and within the psychiatry movement, as it developed in many ways out of religion. It was very depressing. I mean, you're reading about electroshock, you're reading about people being castrated or giving hormone injections, and just a litany of really negative, horrible experiences. And after a while, I thought, gosh, can I really continue with this? This is really hard.
Because it's traumatizing to even read it.
It is. But there's also a point for me I found where it became energizing. It didn't become demoralizing. It gave me an impetus to finish the master's work, to change the way people treat and view queer people in our communities. So I think there can be a time where it shifts from just being really depressing to almost giving me like an energetic anger, you know, like a drive to change things.
Yes. And so I think that that could be a way of describing that point of empowerment. I mean, we're talking very much about two-spirit identities, about multi-generational trauma. When I think of language, two phrases that come up for me is the concept of, and I'll use it in terms of we, in terms of definition, but the concept of Jimshkogabwayong, the concept of us standing strong. It doesn't mean that we're without fear. It doesn't mean that we're without pain, but it means that we're standing in that place of being proud. We're holding who we are up. The other concept is of Je Zhong De Eyong, which is the concept of, they say bravery, but it's about having, being in your heart in a good way. So that's facing that fear.
Mm-hmm.
That's going through those tears. That's using that anger in a healthy way.
Because I know,
For
my own family, I've seen examples, including in my own life, where things are painful, so people hide in a substance because it provides a temporary relief from that intense
alcohol,
pain.
Drugs, a variety of sources.
But I think the idea of being able to stand with that pain in your heart, I think that can be really empowering because it's sort of like, this is going to be really bad, but let's face it and see what we can do.
From my perspective, when I think of the fact that we fall into addictions often when we go through pain, be that addiction to alcohol, substances, sex, work, there's a variety of them. It's a way of avoiding healing.
Interesting, because I've often thought of it as a way of avoiding pain, but it's interesting you frame it as a way of avoiding healing.
Because we're trying to avoid the pain, but that pain is us healing.
Wow.
Those tears are us healing. That anger is us healing. It's our body, it's our mind, it's our spirit responding to what's happened in order to correct the imbalance.
It's interesting because when you're physically injured, people will say don't pick at it or,
it's going to hurt or,
it'll be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It'll ache or whatever.
But you're going to need to suck it up and deal with it.
But people don't really often do that with a mental healing, you know?
Yeah, so that's that thing. That pain is that healing. Now, it doesn't mean that we don't have trouble sometimes and get stuck in it, or that we don't need help. We do. That's one of the things. Same as if you cut your arm. You may need stitches.
Yeah.
You may need antibiotics. You may need some traditional medicines. That's part of that medicine process to help that heal. But the pain is the healing.
Because I know I've often gotten stuck in pain, particularly around, say, issues related to sexuality or gender. But for me, I find the community support has often been a way to help me move forward.
Yes.
Because there may be moments where I'm not sure what path leads out of this pain, but other people have already taken that journey and said, well, this is what worked for me. And and I can kind of follow their marks, you know?
In that sense, that community support is the medicine.
Mm.
Where your alternate to that medicine would have been substance abuse.
Exactly,
or addiction.
Yeah.
Because then you wouldn't have been engaging with this community. You would have been engaging with the substance.
Mm. Which, it can be great. Like, substance abuse can be
yes.
a wonderful temporary reprieve from
yes.
intense suffering. But it never changes the thing that's really bothering you.
No, it doesn't hit the root.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's just treating symptoms.
Yeah. And I find oftentimes that even in our community social services, health services today, it's compartmentalized, it's segmented. So we treat the addiction.
Yeah.
We don't treat the cause.
Yeah, they can teach you how to be abstinent, but they
yeah.
don't...
Treatment centers
yeah,
focus
don't dig
on
into
this...
what
no.
was it that was...
They're terrified to open that box.
Well, I mean, who knows what could be in there? Like, for each person, it's
yes.
their own personal hellish box, right?
But that's that next step, once that addiction's cleared out, is what's in that box?
Yeah. That's a scary thought, I think, is the challenge of looking inside what's in your own box and
yeah.
being
or
alone with
however
your own
you
demons,
want to word
you know?
That. But if we don't look in that box, we can fall back into that addiction or a different one
mm-hmm.
or... It's not that adaption. It's not that moving forward. It's not that removal of that poison or that going, oh, this isn't a poison, this is a strength.
Mm-hmm.
How are that's viewed? So I think that those are some of the ways that I view multi-generational trauma in connection with queer community. But I think that it's important when you're looking at Aboriginal LGBT-identified or two-spirit individuals is that they have two major sources of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
They have the multi-generational impacts of residential school and colonialization and what's happened to them as an Aboriginal person. And then they have a multi-generational 400-500-year history of what's happened in queer community in colonial nations.
Mm.
When you look around the world, almost everywhere homosexuality is illegal or has been criminalized or has been claimed as a mental illness, have been colonial countries.
And I do see a big impact in queer community around that history. Like, I see people who are afraid to go and get help for depression or anxiety because they know that history or they have inherited that anxiety around, like, doctors see who I am as a person as itself an illness.
Yeah.
And that...
Well, even to this day, we still identify trans as an illness.
Yeah. And I understand it can be expedient in terms of, you know, getting...
It can be beneficial within a medical system.
But, yeah, I mean, you have to ask yourself, what's the cost of medicalizing who I am as a person?
Well, and also, do we need to medicalize trans people in order to support them through those surgeries?
Mm.
That's a question within the healthcare system. But we force people within these traumatizing boxes... in order to make certain things work. So I think what's of value is that for two-spirit people, neither trauma has ceased.
Oh, that's a good point.
Things are getting better
mm-hmm.
in queer community, but homophobia, biphobia, transphobia isn't gone. We are still in a heteronormative society that's still traumatizing in its own right. We are still in a community where Aboriginal people are fighting for the rights for their heritage. We're in one of the few countries, if not the only country in the world, that defines its Aboriginal nation's citizenship.
Yeah.
I mean, we can go into the diversity of other issues that are going on with an Aboriginal community, but we're in a nation that is being traumatized in terms of Aboriginal relations on a daily basis. And I think that that's important to note, that trauma is continuing. It has multi-generational history, but it's still happening today. We're still living through pieces of trauma.
And I guess the things that we do today to respond to that trauma is going to impact the generations that are coming after us.
Yes.
I want to thank you for talking to me about intergenerational trauma and for sharing some of the information that you've had around Two-Spirited Teachings. And I look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you.